Welcome to this episode of the Super Yacht Laundry podcast spin-off series, Balls of Wisdom. Obviously, you may know from other episodes, I wanted to do a spin-off series so I can speak to some trailblazers, great voices on the male side of our industry. And today I'm joined by Paul Shepherd. Hi, Paul. How are you today?
Hi. Yeah, good, thank you. Good. Looking forward to having a chat, and I'm glad that I've made it into the Balls of Wisdom category. That's quite flattering.
Well, it's one of those things where you're thinking of a name, and I'm just like, well, I'm Pearls of Wisdom. And also that sometimes, you know, obviously listening to other podcasts, take it all too seriously. You know,
oh, I like it. It's cheeky. Yeah. It's fun. I fully support. I love it.
You know, it's kind of, I want normal conversations because there's loads of people that are a lot more better at the technical, professionalism, all of that kind of stuff. So I thought the title kind of shows, well, kind of explains that it's a bit of fun, you know, a bit of fun, but with a bit of learning, bouncing ideas. So yeah, Balls of Wisdom is what I came up with and it's kind of stuck. So yeah, welcome to it. Thanks for wanting to talk. I just to obviously let the listeners know, I didn't know Paul existed as an individual until I went to the Super Yacht Forum last year in November, and you just, it was just so nice to hear you speak. I think it's one of those things where no offense to everybody else who speaks, but the conversations on a lot of things, especially with safety, has been a bit stunted for a while. And you were up on stage and you really blew me away. Not only were you talking about CHIRP and the amazing things you do there, but you had the confidence to kind of talk about outside the box and thinking and stuff like that. So yeah. And then after that, I stalked you a little bit. And then I asked you to be on the podcast. And then apparently you've known my family for ages. Anyway.
Well, this is the most concerning thing, because clearly as a family, you don't communicate at all. Because I've had lunch with your husband, I don't know, half a dozen times or so. And I've known your son for God knows how long. We did his prep with my company for his oral exam.
Stepson, I'm not old enough to
communicating, stepson. I apologize. So there you go.
Yeah, so it was just really weird when we spoke the other day. I'm just like, oh, okay then. We do, well, yeah. We do talk as a family, but we don't talk about generally the same stuff at the same time.
You don't talk about me, which is disappointing, to be honest.
Oh, no. Well, there's so much to talk about. I was just saying how Scandinavian you look. Considering you're in Cyprus, you could be in Norway. To be honest.
Well, yeah, absolutely. But the thing is that Cyprus is desperately trying to replicate Norway at the moment. It's not minus 20, but it's not plus 20 either.
It's a cold snap.
Yeah. People were telling me that Cyprus gets cold in winter, and I was like, don't be silly. Of course it doesn't. And yes, it's not as cold as it is in the UK, obviously. But it's not short and t-shirt all year round, unfortunately.
You sound very disappointed about that.
I am.
Gutted. Well, at least, like, hopefully you're not one of those guys that wear shorts all year round, because they kind of freak me out a little bit.
I won't stand up and then we won't know.
True. That's very true. I dropped my kid off at school the other day and there was a dad there and he was wearing shorts, you know, middle of summer, Parma, is wearing like boating shoes, little ankle socks and short shorts. I'm like, what? It's January, it's freezing. You're like, oh, I just never wear trousers. I'm like, I get that, but you look so weird. I'm literally sat there with a beanie on. All these mums have got these massive coats on because it's Baltic, and he's just standing there in a gilet in a pair of shorts. I'm like,
everyone, I guess, you know, their own choices, I guess.
We've gone off on a tangent anyway. Sorry, that's my fault. Right, okay, enough about appearances. You're the one that pioneered CHIRP coming into the yachting industry. Would you say that's correct?
Yeah, so I can't take credit for CHIRP in general. So CHIRP, the kind of, you know, safety incident reporting, sharing, learning kind of platform, has been around for 40 years in aviation. And well, 43 years now, and 23 years or so in maritime more broadly. But yes, it is kind of my fault that I was the one who said there needs to be a super yacht version of this. And Adam Parnell, who is the director, my boss within it, he basically said, go on then. And I didn't step back fast enough. So there you go. So yes, okay. I can be to blame. I can be blamed fairly for Chirp's entry into yachting, for sure.
Well, it's not blame, but you obviously saw that there was an incredible need. Is that because you heard too many dodgy stories and like, is there any way to kind of, you know, record it?
Then maybe... Well, I mean, I've always, Chirpers, you know, since when I was a cadet in Wasatch College back in, I don't know, the 1940s, you know, I'd pick up the little printed leaflets and everything and have a read and go, this is a cool idea. And I'd always enjoy that and I always learn from it. I wasn't really involved ever. And I think, so I've got a mixed background, you know, commercial, mostly commercial, a little bit CPR. And then I came ashore and I started doing a lot of teaching, doing the oral exam prep with one of my companies. And I was also teaching at Wasatch, doing some of the yacht modules there as well. And I was just talking to more and more, my circle involved more and more yacht people. And whenever you get yacht people in a room together, they start talking. And a lot of things they start talking about, particularly if you've got somebody who's kind of, you know, in an educational thing or safety kind of conversations or whatever, in these courses, a lot of the time, then all these stories come out. And that's great because, you know, the people in the room benefit from hearing those stories and, oh, that happened to me and now that happened to me or whatever, what do you do about it? But it doesn't benefit the wider industry.
If it's gossip in the end of the day, like,
yeah, it's
not recorded.
Exactly. It's still sharing. I mean, it's still sharing and learning in that sense, but it's not doing it in a way that is has as much reach as it could do, nor is it in a way that is kind of as formalized, has those layers of confidentiality which reassure people in that, to make it broader. And I think effectively, if I remember correctly, I was at an event where I bumped into Adam, the director of Chirp Maritime. And I think the two things just kind of happened, to be honest with you, where I just kind of went, right, you need a super yacht version. And then that was kind of that.
And he was like,
one of those chance meetings, as sometimes these things happen. But I really can't take credit for it kind of, maybe I could take credit for the initial idea of it, but really there's a big group of two dozen or so amazing people in the super yacht advisory board who are current crew, or currently involved in yacht management ashore. Who are the ones who review what we're sent in with me, and then kind of when you read the reports, you'll see there's what's been submitted. Then there's like the Chirp comment on it. So you know that those people are absolutely critical to making this happen. And then there's a whole broader network of partners from yacht management companies that think this is an important thing and want to support it, to media partners like yourselves, to any everybody and anybody else who decides to print the thing out or share it on social media or talk to their crew about it or whatever it is. So you know the success of it is by no means down to me.
When you were first kind of, obviously, you know, you're talking to Chirp and they're going to introduce it into the yachting world, you know, did it surprise you how welcomed it was, or were you expecting that you know it was a dire need, or how did it go in the beginning?
It's a very interesting question, because I think if you'd said to people, we want to do this, as in future tense, they'd have gone, can't happen. Nah, yachting's too secretive. Yachting's too confidential. We can't do like the discretion and all that kind of stuff. And so I think that would have been the conversation, and the conversation would have ended, and that was it. But it was the whole project was never driven by your management types, right? The project was driven by individual crew members who are demonstrating that this is worth it and they want to share stuff. So I think you're starting at the right end of the pipeline, if you will, with it. But then actually, because it wasn't an idea, because it already existed, and because, to be honest with you, a lot of the first reports that we had came out of when I was teaching the Seamanship and Met module for Master 3000 at Wasatch. And I would, force is a strong word, but let's just go with force, the students in my class to write me a little report that I could submit to Chirp. And that basically was the starting point for all of these, the pipeline of reports going through. So I think what happened then is when Chirp Superyacht kind of launched in inverted commas. It didn't launch as an idea that anybody could say no to, or it already existed. Chirp's been around for 40 years. The Chirp Superyacht bit already existed and had a pipeline of reports ready to go. And so then at that point, then I was very surprised by how incredibly supportive people were, honestly. There's probably the people who aren't supportive are probably not going to be the ones to come up to you and go, that's a terrible idea, bugger off, are they? Then that's not really how it goes normally. But the number of people who come up to you and go, this is an amazing idea, and we want to support it in whatever way, has been incredible. And you think back to Metz, right? So, or TSF, I guess. I went there 3 years ago, and Chirp was launched, and we basically were stuffed in the smallest room down a corridor, down 17 different turns or whatever, and I think 30 people came to that, of which, you know, kind of a significant proportion were either people who were involved or my mates or people I'd collared on the way along. There might have been like five people who actually went because they were interested, and this time round, you know, a few years later, the one that you attended, Chirp, me, but as Chirp Superyacht, were invited to be on three separate panels in the space of 2 days, and there were 100 plus crowds in each one, and the brainstorm that we ran as part of the Superyacht Alliance think tank bit that Chirp's been asked to run within the Superyacht Alliance, that had a capacity limit on it. And we had to turn people away at the door, 120 people or so coming in to take part of that. So that has been overwhelming, the level of support, for sure.
Yeah, I think it's one of those, thinking about it, it helps if it is already established. I do think the yachting industry does look at its maritime brothers and sisters, knowing that they have a lot more. They have a lot more regulation. They have a lot more stuff to adhere to than the Wild West, which is the yachting industry. And if they're already doing it, then 100% they want to have. Do you know what I mean? There's that probably that feeling that we are official, we are an industry. Of course, it's, we should.
Credibility.
Yeah.
And I think the yachting industry has professionalized so incredibly quickly over the last 10, 15 years. And when I speak to people who have been around in it for longer than I have, you say, Hours of Rest, I think, is a really good example. And Hours of Rest is not something that we've fixed by any means. It's something that is a live problem which people are struggling with day to day. But if you ask somebody who was in the industry 15, 20 years ago, what Hours of Rest was, how it was dealt with back then, they will say that you would have been laughed out of the room if you'd even mentioned the word. And now, when I speak to just crew nowadays, the idea of it is accepted. The legitimacy of it is fully accepted. The only thing is like, are we able to achieve it? And it's a much, much bigger change to go, the cultural change from we don't care to we care is a lot bigger than from we care to we actually manage to do it. And that, I think, just shows how much the industry's changed.
It's changing at a rapid rate of knots, and you would probably say that from your first time at the forum to now, even in that space of time, things have 5 years of doing Pearls, it's rapid and it's fast. And I think, maybe it's the introduction of technology and different things like that. The conversation about all sorts of things, not just Hours of Rest, it has sped up, and the professionalism that they're looking at and trying to implement, I don't see it slowing down, but with this speed of, everybody recognizing that the industry should be professionalized, and also wanting to professionalize so we don't become a laughing stock, because, I don't know, you wouldn't have been in one of the seminars that I was in at the forum, individuals and companies from the luxury brand realizing that they are, putting all of this effort with the owners and putting all of this luxury stuff, and then we're putting individuals to look after the stuff that perhaps don't have the right amount of training and they're not being looked after. we kind of get in like a bit of a weird face, you know, like, you're doing what kind of thing? And I use, you know, I use, obviously becoming from the female side of things, you know, I can, you know, a girl can be working in the pub around the corner, and in 24 hours she could be serving a drink to a high net worth person with, you know, really only very basic qualifications, nothing to do with high end service, which kind of blows your mind a little bit, because you can't go to the Savoy and then just in 24 hours go from the Crown Pub to the Savoy and start serving these people. It's just like, it's like a bit, it's a bit crazy. There's that anomaly. The hours of resting, I think, is really interesting, because like you said, we've, you've moved on from, it's a joke to even, maybe you're even weak, a bit of like a, oh, you know, if you can't handle the job.
Yeah, they're kind of slightly masochistic tendencies that some yacht crew have. Yeah. If they're not working 28 hours a day, they're not doing it properly.
If you're not tough. But I think also that's also one of, there's lots of sticking points at the moment in the industry, is the hours of rest that they're trying to implement won't work because there's not enough people on board to really make them work. I think there's like a bit of a clash at the moment.
I think it depends on size a lot of the time, really. And I think it depends on, if it's not size, it depends on operation. Hours of rest related problems, in my experience and from what I hear, although you have more experience on the interior department conversations. But typically, if you're talking, you know, 40, 50 meter down, then you're likely to have some really serious hours of rest issues, because there aren't enough people. But I don't think when we have this conversation, I don't think it's right for us to start off with saying the hours of rest regs are wrong because we don't have enough people. The regs are correct. The problem is we don't have enough people. Mm. And so we need to get that right in terms of which way we're talking about it. And then if you talk to most captains, And you know, I had a conversation the other day about MLC, Maritime Labour Convention, which has, you know, requirements for crew cabins and space and all this kind of stuff. And you know, and somebody was complaining that it doesn't fit into the yachting sector, because how many times does a naval architect or a designer start building a yacht based around a really large crew accommodation area that's very generous in the space, right? Of course not. But if you speak to most captains, they're not going to say we prefer to have 25% bigger cabins. They're going to say we prefer to have 25% more crew.
Yeah.
And I think that's really the key thing. And then the operation is important, because if you have got that 40, 50 meter that does, you know, a couple of weekend trips for a quiet old family or whatever, for a single season in the med and whatever, they work, you know, they work a bit for a couple of days and then they have a break. Then maybe that's fine, right? Maybe the hours of rest suits that type of operation, and maybe that is sustainable. But then we can't apply the exact same crewing requirements, the minimum safe manning document. We can't apply the same crewing requirements to that vessel as we can to one that is the same size, perhaps, but is doing, you know, dual season back-to-back charters, you know, with no time off in between.
I think it's something to, you know, it's like we said, talking about naval architects, you know, they're coming in, they want to build something nice for the owner and all of that kind of thing, which, looking at something nice is obviously lovely. But on board, and obviously we talked about this, obviously, when we've chatted, it's the feeling, it's the, you know, when you're on board, it's more the experience of being there. And like, you know, we've talked briefly, you know, off the podcast, the interior for me is one of the most important, because you create the feeling, you know, you create the guest feeling of being relaxed and not being stressed out. And if you've just done a 12-hour turnaround from your last charter and literally everybody's running on 3 hours sleep, you're not going to pull out the dream holiday. You know, with the best win in the world, you'll do your best. But humans are feeling things, you know, you will feel that person that's serving you is literally exhausted or literally running off pure Red Bull and caffeine and maybe those macaroon things, which are just like pure sugar. That's how I used to survive. You know, it's, there's things to look at for sure. But at least now, and obviously you can say the conversations are now being had. Like you said, you know, the conversation about hours of rest, you know, started. Where we are now, it's brought up more questions probably than it's you know, it's really solved anything right now.
On the larger vessels, I think it's kind of solved. If you speak to you know, heads of department on larger vessels, they've typically got plenty of crew. They don't really have significant hours of rest problems, at least in deck and engine. Maybe I'm not speaking to the right people in the interior. But yeah, it's a big enough thing. You've got enough volume, you've got enough cabins, you've got enough crew. But yeah, it's definitely not solved in those smaller areas. And I think to bring it back to the interior, I think we often just overlook the whole interior department, you know, from service, housekeeping, galley, laundry, the whole lot. And it doesn't make a lot of sense, right? It doesn't make sense from a safety perspective, because yes, you know, the guys on the deck like me, or the guys in downstairs in the pits, in the engineers, would probably like to think they're more important. But we can have accidents just as successfully in a laundry or in a galley if we're exhausted as we can elsewhere on board. So, you know, we need to take that into consideration. And just thinking about just fire safety, I was thinking about earlier on, but when I was before I came on with you, there are typically three high risk areas that are considered for fire on board a vessel. Yep. One is the engine room, for obvious reasons. The other two are the laundry and the galley, not the bridge or, you know, the bosun store or whatever. And the problem is, when you get into these conversations, sometimes everybody's like, oh, my department's more important, whatever. No, it's not. Every department is doing its bit. But if every department's doing its bit, then we also need to make sure we're paying attention to the interior, which is a large department that is doing, you know, doing a lot of different things. But also, yeah, I think your point that you made is, as much as we might not like it, this is a service industry. Yeah. This is a hotel.
It's a floating hotel. Exactly. Like,
exactly. And while it's incredibly important that the lights work and the toilets are flushing, obviously that's important. And while it's really important that it doesn't run aground and sink, like, obviously that's also important. But in terms of owner experience, if the interior isn't operating at 100%, then the guest experience is not going to be operating at 100%. Absolutely.
No, it literally baffles me. I can take my mind back to, I was having real problems with one of my chief stews. Like, she was exhausted. Do you know what I mean? We ended up having this massive row in the pantry, like huge. I was like, what are you doing? Like, anyway.
The kind of row that is after kind of like a couple of days of no sleep and too much Red Bull, right? that kind of row. Yeah.
Basically raging that, you know, having to pick up slack and all of that kind of stuff. A guest came in and told us to be quiet.
No.
Because they could hear us. Do you know what I mean? So, you know, the interior, one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you and get you on the podcast, because one of my takeaways from the forum, and you specifically, talking about minimum manning, this level that apparently boats have to function at, because I think that is possibly going to be the root of all change and maybe all evil in some respects. Like, so for prime example, you're talking about a fire hazard on board. I've worked on a boat where the designer said that they're didn't need to be, when they designed the laundry, I needed to be able to access to remove the lint from the tumble dryer, because obviously that's a big fire hazard. What's
that is called? The primary fire risk of laundry.
That's the gross about it. I was told that the tumble dryer was self-cleaning, and it, no offense, but it was a very timber kind of interior. I'm like, well, that's not good. And that's right next to the crew area as well. So, you know, these things, we think, you know, and that was, okay, that, you know, that was a few years ago now, probably over, you know, coming up to a decade ago. But that still shouldn't have, you know, considering how many articles, how many fires would have happened up until that point, that still shouldn't even be a thing that's argued in the design concept of a laundry.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, would it be interesting to mention a couple of the interior related reports that we have had?
Oh, go for it.
Yeah, so there's a couple that, well, the thing about the goss is, and I don't know if you want to actually at some point describe what chirp is to your listeners, because we are kind of assuming a little bit there. But then we have this basically confidential reporting platform. Reporting sounds a bit pointed. We can think of it as just sharing. This happened to me. I prefer it doesn't happen to you, effectively. And it's incredibly confidential, to the point where I'm the chair of what's called the super yacht advisory board, that group in the middle, and the secretariat won't tell us like the name or the name of the vessel or the location of where these reports came from. So, and if they won't tell us anything about it, it's nuts, right? It's that level of confidentiality. But it's just, this happened to me, I don't want to happen to you, and we can all benefit from that, right? Whether we're the one sharing it or the one reading it or listening to the podcast, and I can tell you about it. So there's a couple that spring to mind. One, which was a bit of a surprise, is there's the oily rags in the engine room thing has been a kind of a source of potential fire hazards, kind of, you know, for God knows how long. But I'd never ever heard of it happen in the laundry. So you had some rags from the galley that had a lot of olive oil on them, and they'd been in the wash and in the dryer or something, and then they came out hot, but they must have been really soaked in olive oil because they weren't fully clean. Mm-hmm. So now we've got pile of hot rags still with lots of, you know, oil in them, and the stew left the laundry to go and do something, have a coffee break or whatever, went back in, and the laundry was full of smoke. Luckily, it hadn't actually kind of gone off at that point. It was just smoking. But that was just olive oil. It's mad. There's another one where the steam pipe on an iron that had, you know, kind of obviously pretty industrial kind of laundry equipment here. And that was, it was not being very well maintained. It was perished, and it popped one day. And luckily, nobody got scolded. They managed to get away from it and shut it down quickly. But that was a case of poor maintenance. Like there was two irons or whatever there that they were both perished, and they just needed to be taken care of and treated as a safety issue, right? Can we come back to what we were talking about earlier on? We're not wanting to replace this in the laundry, sorry, in the interior, because everything in the interior just needs to be pretty. We're wanting to do it because it's a steam iron and that's a steam pipe, and I don't want to get, you know, half my arm scalded off. And other ones, just a galley one where we had a knob for turning on the galley plates, which kind of protruded a bit from the edge of the kind of housing or whatever it was in, and it just kept getting knocked on. And it kind of, they kind of knew about it. It kind of happened every so often because you're going to walk past it, whatever, and you're just going to knock it a bit. But this time it got knocked on when there was something on top of it, like a box of stores or something. I can't remember the details exactly. And then the chef left to go and do something, came back in, fire. And luckily that was, because it was under the galley hood, it was suppressed by the fixed system. But, you know, quick three off the top of my head, without having prepared for this podcast particularly well at all, that just show that, you know, yeah, accidents happen there. But the thing that I think we can talk about, and I'd like to get some, you know, input from your listeners potentially, is we get those reports typically from the deck department. Mm. So we get them from the safety officer or from, you know, another personnel. As far as I'm aware, from what I'm allowed to be told about these reports, is that we're not getting those directly from interior personnel. Now that makes me think two things. One is, is it an awareness thing? Because, you know, maybe that's it. They just don't know that chirp exists as an opportunity to learn and share from these things. Or is it, you know, kind of issues or fears around confidentiality? Or is it fears that maybe that's not my place to share it, because, you know, that's more of a safety officer kind of thing to do, you know? So we need to try and break down these barriers a bit better.
I would hazard a guess, and obviously, you know, maybe we could actually try and get more information, that the security the safety incidences that happen in the interior aren't serious enough to warrant reporting to CHIRP. because it's not the interior, it's not the engine room, and it's not the bridge. So the boat's still floating, it's still moving. So as far as the interior, you know, is, I really do think, and like I said, said to you, it's not valued the interior as it should. There is a real disparity, and then that is having a ripple effect when it comes to safety. Not, and obviously it's always a hot topic, you know, mental health and what's going on with women in the interior when it comes to all sorts of harassment, bullying and stuff like that. But what about basic safety? I mean, one of the things that you highlighted, and I'd never heard, or maybe I had, but I wasn't paying attention. I'd never heard anybody talk about the minimum manning. And while you were talking, I'm like, so when it comes to, you know, explain what minimum manning is first. And
So there's a piece of paper called a minimum safe manning document. Forgive the gendered language. That's just what it's called in regulation. We can think of it as crewing levels, and each vessel will have one of those, and it's every vessel, you know, cruise ships, cargo ships, yachts, above a certain size, and that will basically say that you need to have one person with a master's ticket, you need to have, you know, one person with an OW ticket, you need to have one chief engineer, one engineer ticket, and a cook, for example, and maybe a couple of ABs, which is deckhands, you know, and obviously that varies depending on the size of the vessel, but, you know, the absolute minimum, we'll be talking about those kind of positions. So, and that sets the required standard for moving the vessel from A to B. So one of the problems, if we leave aside the interior for a moment, one of the problems that we have in the way that that these are issued and kind of used is that for most ships, the work is really done in port. And so you're in port, you unload your cargo, you load your cargo, whatever, and then you go. And all you're really doing then is just going. You're just navigating, right? The engine's running, you point it in the right direction, you try not to run into anything, you serve a couple of meals a day, job done. And so that level of manning is kind of here. But what it doesn't consider is the operations that are going to be done when you're at sea.
Yep.
Because it's just sailing from one place to another, right? And that's part of the problem that we have in the yachting sector, is if we've got this minimum safe manning document, which will be the crew that is required to move the yacht from A to B on a repositioning voyage without guests, you know, without any impending guest trips, that's your minimum level of manning. But that isn't what a yacht does most of the time.
Okay.
And so that's why we need to consider what I'm calling kind of minimum operational safe manning. It is to say, actually, at different types of operations, we mentioned earlier on about your, you know, very low use, quiet family, summer holidays only type boat, which is one type of operation. And they may decide that in that kind of operation, you need to have, you know, X crew. But if that same boat is being used to do something that's in significantly more intense, it's just not the same operation. Yes, it's a yacht. Yes, it's the same size, but it's not the same job.
No.
So we need to make sure that the job have enough people to do what's being asked of it. And if we're being asked to, you know, anchor for the day, get all the water sports toys out, mm-hmm. have parties on board, you know, have all the guests doing all the stuff all the time, and then lift the anchor, sail overnight to the next place, then that's not the same job. And we need to make sure there's enough people. And then the second point of this, of course, which is actually, this just shows how the blind spots that we have, including me, is that you're the one who pointed out that the interior isn't even on the safe manning document at all, except cook. You know, so
this appears, and this is like I said, like I literally had, you know, when you were talking, obviously I'd never really thought about it, obviously trying to work out how, you know, looking at how women are affected on board and our situation, and obviously trying to get qualifications, recognition, all of these things, you know, that we've gone on and on and on about. But in the very basic, very, very basic, this functionality of the boat and a team of maybe six women just becomes, well, and men, but women, just becomes completely invisible. They're not even recognized as being present, let alone functional.
You really have made me think about it, honestly, because you just think,
safe? No, but in all honesty, how can them being invisible actually make them safe?
No, and that's exactly it. And I think that that really is the point that you've made. You know, I'm not from an interior background, and you've made really made me reflect on, and maybe some people listening to this might reflect on it as well, is that if you have an entire department which minus one cook is completely invisible as far as the regulations are concerned in terms of the crewing of the vessel, then what does that mean for the way that the rest of everything perceives those people? And you know, you've there are no now, of course, we have the guest program with all of their various, you know, interior related qualifications. Huge respect to the guys who have put all that together. But within our kind of SDCW, the you know, the international standards for training, certification, and watchkeeping, they don't exist.
No.
And they're apart from basic safety training, that's it. Which doesn't really make any sense, does it?
Well, not considering where you flip it all the way around, and obviously I mentioned it briefly earlier, 70% of guest engagement is with the invisible team. Do you know what I mean? Your everything that you're building up for and this whole purpose of this boat is, you know, the reason why it exists, the team that are going to be dealing with that experience and that owner doesn't exist. I'm like, it just blows my
But I think
mind.
there's more to it than that. If you start to think about it from, you know, safety training. When we talk, when I go on board and I do, as well as all the oral exam preparation, which my company does, which is sure, I also go on board yachts and I do various bits of training, or you know, whatever we're asked to do, to be honest with you. And a lot of the time, I'll go and say to the purser or the chief stew, oh, do you guys want to do some training? And I get two responses. One is surprise that they were even asked is the first one, because, but yeah, but you're here for the deck crew, aren't you? And maybe the engineers or whatever. It's like, no, we can all do something. The first one is surprise, and the second one is, yeah, absolutely, we'd love to. And the level of enthusiasm that I'm received with when I say, would you guys like to talk about fire extinguishers for half an hour? And like most people would probably roll their eyes at the idea of being lectured about fire extinguishers. These mostly young women are absolutely enthusiastic as anything about it. And they're just as capable of holding a fire extinguisher and putting out a fire as anybody else is. But they're just like, why are they never the focus of this kind of training?
I would argue, obviously, I know engineers, they've got their thing and everything else, but we deal with more chemicals than a lot of people on the boat. You know, we have all of our cleaning products. Obviously, we're dealing with machines that can literally set the whole thing ablaze. You know, and obviously, again, interacting with the galley, which is also a very volatile onboard area. It's, you know, from a safety, it's just a massive missed opportunity. You know, obviously we, you know, we had a sinking not so long ago, and obviously I was reading about the situation, how fast the boat sank and everything else. I'm like, if you think about, you know, safety procedures, they'll send it like a deckhand or, you know, something, you know, they'll end up sending somebody who doesn't know the interior inside and out. We literally clean it with a toothpick and a cotton bud. There's not an inch of the interior that we don't know that that piece of furniture moves or that door opens that way or all of these things. You know, from a guest point of view, not to really utilize these individuals on the interior to ensure that if there's any problems, all of the guests can be evacuated. Again, an insanely missed opportunity. Now I know that obviously in a lot of safety protocols, you know, it is down to the chief stew or whatever to get it, but I still don't feel like it's utilized the way, you know, potentially that it could. But it all root it, you know, it all feeds back to, if you don't exist, do you know what I mean? You know, when
No,
you're looking at other area, you know, other departments where, you know, obviously in minimum manning, they need to understand that it takes three deckhands to do that if you wanted to get underway and this, that, and the other. You know, if they're struggling, you know, at least they're there.
at least somebody's considering that they exist. Yeah, no, absolutely. And the other thing is that most of the vessel's volume is guest space, right? You know, it's not going to be mostly crew cabins, is it, or mostly engine room? I'm sure the engineers would like that, but unfortunately not. And so then if we just think about it from a purely like a safety perspective, we've talked about the fact that out of the three spaces that we've got, two of them are in the interior, but also the larger proportion of the vessel's space is interior space, is guest space. So if we're not making sure that the people who inhabit that space on a day-to-day basis are as trained as we possibly can make them in initial fire detection or initial fire suppression or extinction, then because most fires start out this big, but every single fire on the planet has ever started out that big, and if they can be tackled when they're that big, then vessel saved, everyone goes home for tier medals. If we wait 20 minutes, we've lost the vessel. And if we're not making sure that every single stew is able to detect that something's gone on and put it out. I was once wandering around a yacht, and there was some candles that had been left out, and that they were sort of dripping, well, not dripping wax, but whatever. They could have set fire to the little bit of paper napkin that was something that was underneath it. And I was there when it happened, and I put it out with a glass of water. And great, perfect, tier medals, everybody's happy. But if I hadn't been there, somebody didn't know what to do about it, then we'd end up with a huge fire. And it's a big, big drama.
There's loads of things. I mean, and look at that poor situation that's happened just recently in that bar. Those stupid Roman candle things, you know, that I really don't understand it. I have been in places where they've all come out with those Roman candles. Yay, someone's bought a magnum of champagne. I don't get it. But anyway, they have them on board. They have these, you know, high, it's like a firework, and we're going to have it on the aft deck. We might even serve it in the interior at the table. Do you know what I mean? Idea, you know, these are new things that we're unfortunately through tragedy are realizing.
Yeah.
But again, you know, should they be on board? What's the ceiling
To be honest with you, I think the short answer is no. But actually, then, if you can allow me to be really, really boring for a minute and talk about risk assessment. Ready? Sigh, groan. Is that risk assessment is you say the word risk assessment to somebody, and they'll typically, particularly a junior crew member, they'll typically, firstly, they'll roll their eyes at you. But secondly, they'll think that it's something that somebody else does, right? They'll think it's something that maybe it's the chief stew's job, but probably not. It's probably something that the safety officer does, or maybe somebody ashore, or maybe the captain, or, you know, whatever. It's definitely not something that they do. And again, if we, by ignoring a significant proportion of the vessel's crew and not taking the time to inculcate some of these ways of thinking, risk, if you get rid of some of the boring terminology for a minute, and you just think about the root of it. Hazard is the thing. We've got how likely is this to go wrong? Likelihood. How bad would it be if it went wrong? Severity. And the combination of those two is risk. Mm. And if we have more people and especially an entire department that are now thinking, what could go wrong? And how bad would it be if it did? And how likely is it to happen? And therefore, maybe we should have a chat about that, because I'm not sure that's a really good, very good idea. And it could be a thousand different things, from use of chemicals, from, sparklers, Roman candles in the interior, through to a thousand other jobs. Mm. But if we actually try to embed that thinking, then we're going to have a lot safer vessel. Sure.
I think one of the things I will point out, and I'm not trying to, the women on the interior, women are more cautious than men. Genetically, when you go to a beach, there's a boy and a girl, there's something that's just come up on the shore, it looks gross, a boy will get a stick and poke it, a girl will be like, what is that, let's maybe just see whether it moves, kind of thing. I do think the reason why there's not more accidents on the interior is because women are very conscious, and they are very forward thinking when it comes to risks as well, which I think is good credit to us as
as a species.
Why these things aren't just floating torches across the world is because women are quite we're quite intelligent people. We do know where risk is. But what I think should happen is there is a we're not really getting great value by not even recognizing that they should even do it. Do you know what I mean? You will get women, and then you combine that with, you know, the what we've talked about, hours of rest. You get a whole bunch of women that are absolutely exhausted. Is there a chance they could miss something? Is there, you know, they not observant? Of course, but they don't exist anyway, so who's worried?
But I think you make a reasonable point, to be honest with you. If I was on the Balls of Steel Deck podcast, I probably wouldn't really have the space to agree with you. But honestly, the one thing that the interior is
it's not bad, is it?
No, I prefer what notable balls or whatever it was that you're calling this one. I can't remember. There is a problem in the deck department, that's for sure. That you have a bunch of testosterone-addled, you know, 20-year-olds running around, you know, like, how amazing is all of this fun stuff we get to do? And yeah, like, that's a problem, for sure. Because, you know, you end up with these people, you know, if I can say it, you know, thinking with an appendage that perhaps isn't the right one that we should be thinking about, you know, and not wearing a life jacket because, you know, it's not a bro thing to do, and all this. And it's just like, just grow up, fine. Like, you know, like, we need to employ a bunch of like geriatrics, I think, and just, you know, to end up with a nice safe space where we're not doing those types of sillinesses, or we could let a bunch of women do it, because, you know, actually just a bit more sensible and not trying to compete with each other the entire time as to what level of stupidity
we still compete, but in a different way.
Not to do the most stupid thing you possibly can. That's the difference. But I mean, I think. The fact this is a women-focused podcast, Super Yandri, love it, awesome. It's great to make that space for it. But I think it might just be better if we just try to avoid thinking about this in gendered terms. Mm. Because I was thinking about what you said the other day with who's in the fire team, right?
Yeah.
Now, who's in the fire team? Deck crew.
Just let them go. The deckies go first.
Exactly. They can go and burn. It'll be fine. They'll love it. You know, and therefore men.
Yeah. Right.
And the traditional argument would be for that is that, well, men are physically stronger. And if you got to drag somebody out of a space, then that would be helpful. Okay, cool. In that case, let's not assume that the gym obsessed, you know, 5'10", whatever, you know, Stew, who is hard as nails, is the person who shouldn't be in there, whereas the, you know, the weedy 18-year-old deckhand who doesn't even know what a dumbbell is, let alone lift one up. You know, if the argument is that actually it's about we need to make sure that we've got the right people in the team, well, then make sure we've got the right people in the team. Yeah. You know, one of Monica's friends who lives here in Cyprus she's like hardcore, like weightlifter kind of deal. She could quite easily pick me up and throw me across the room. And so if there's a fire team choice between me and her, provided that we have been given the equal training and everything else, then she's actually a much better choice if you want to get carried out of a space than me. But we're just always work on the assumption that it's got to be the deck. We've got all these people. Let's make best use of all of them, not just ignore a whole department.
Well, no, but it's also the thing, you know, if there's a fire in the engine room, the engineer's going to want to go in there. If there's a fire in the interior, an interior person will be able to locate it and put it out. You know, let's work on the premise that it's not a body we want to drag. We want to put the fire out. Sending an engineer into the interior or a deckhand, because we don't let deckhands into the interior generally, is a futile exercise because they won't know that. But also behind that panel is a hidden cupboard with a whole bunch of chemicals in it. Deckhand won't know that. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So again,
no, you're absolutely right. It's not just a physical thing. You're absolutely right. It's also. I guess I was thinking in like a generic fire in a generic space. In which case, let's choose the right person. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It doesn't make sense when you do a fire entry into the engine room in a fire. You make sure there's an engineer in the team, or you have the second engineer in charge of that fire party. When we have a fire in the interior, we send the deck crew in.
Yeah. Because we don't let them in.
Obviously.
They're never allowed in. They have to ask permission to be allowed in the interior. That's how often they get to go inside. So no, I just think, you know, like you said, you know, the reason why we've, you know, hours of rest is where it is because the conversation was started. I think now there are, but it's kind of, it's snowballed a little bit because it now needs and has drawn attention to other areas. But I think, you know, my and what I will be working on in 2026, and if I'm given the opportunity at the forum, I shall be asking the question, why does the interior not exist? You know, because it's an incredibly missed opportunity for a number of reasons, but you could start with safety and then emanate outwards, you know. But I think with what you're doing with Chirp is, the industry is really like, it's slow and it's methodical and everything else, but you need to report, you need data to go, hi guys, kind of getting loads of like, you know, incidences through with these things. So perhaps we need to look at it, talk about it a bit more. And unless the industry has data, I don't know whether it would happen naturally. I doubt it. Do you know what I mean?
Well, of course.
That's
not. I mean,
I think really important.
Thank you. The reason these things exist is because they haven't been dealt with, right? They haven't been tackled, so they're not just going to magically disappear of their own accord. But Chirp does two things. I think it's worth kind of highlighting. There's the kind of, should we say, more historical bit of it, which is that something happened to me, let's say something in the laundry caught fire or whatever, no, with the oily rags we mentioned earlier on. And that could have happened to the person who reported it yesterday or 10 years ago, and it's fine. Like, it doesn't matter when it happened, but there's a lesson that can be learned there. And if we want, as an industry, to grow, and as an individual, we want the industry to improve, and we want to stop other people from getting hurt, we can say, I'd like to share that to help everybody else. But the other thing that Chirp does is kind of jumping in there in the moment to actually deal with problems. So you are aware of IceOne, which does incredible work around the sort of welfare, crew welfare kind of area. Chirp is more on the safety side of it, but there's obviously an overlap in the middle of those two. And when we get talking to, you know, talk about that kind of immediate bit, it breaks my heart to say it, but Chirp has had phone calls or, you know, contact from people who are and I'm going to assume it was a woman, but actually I don't know the gender of the reporter, so I can't be certain, but let's just assume, who was currently hiding in her cabin from the captain, having been terrorized and chased around this vessel for months of, you know, of the captain trying to place themselves in a position where they can have personal conversations and just being a bit of a creep, to be honest. And this person was at the absolute end of their tether, didn't know what to do, was just desperate for some help, some support, and they called Chirp, and so one of the two guys who are the kind of in the secretariat, I mentioned Adam, his right hand chap called Dave, who was also part of an organization called Befrienders Worldwide, so they offer a lot more of that kind of support to people. He was able to step in to you know, offer some signposting and some guidance to that crew member, and luckily they you know, left the vessel without harm being done to them, which is you know, it's a positive outcome, right? Mm-hmm. Now of course you could say, well, why are they the one leaving the vessel? And I would absolutely agree with you.
That's a big conversation.
That may be a conversation for podcast number two, Balls of Steel edition. And so, but the other part of it is in that immediate part is we get, and this is a deck example, but I think we can apply some other, you know, kind of, we can imagine other examples to it, is we get photos, for example, of people working aloft doing stupid stuff, relatively frequently. And so, you know, work aloft, going up on the top of the superstructure, you know, cleaning the mast, cleaning the sat domes, whatever it's going to be. And we've got crew up there who are standing on a wet, slippery, sloping, shiny surface with nothing below them except either a bit of yacht poking out because of a shell door open or the key or water, which turns into solid when you drop 10 meters, 20 meters down onto it, and no no securing, no safety harness, no nothing, nobody watching them. It is simply luck that we don't have more fatalities from work aloft within the yachting sector. And we'll get sent a photo of somebody doing that. Maybe it's from a crew member on another boat. And they, maybe they don't feel confident enough to go round to the boat and say, "Oi, chaps, do better." But they will, sometimes just do a quick report in the moment to us. And the secretariat will literally get on the phone to the flag state of the yacht and say, and send them the photo and say, "What on earth is going on aboard your vessel right now? Fix it. Do your job." And obviously they'll say it slightly more politely than that, but you get the idea. And the flag state will, and to be fair, for the most part, the response from the flag states is absolutely fantastic, is, "We will get on that right now. Like, that is not acceptable." And they will call either the management company or the vessel, and that gets fixed. It gets resolved. And I don't know the identity of the person who sends that photo in. Maybe we assume it's the chief officer or a member of the deck crew on boat A, but maybe it's not. But my point here in the interior context is, maybe it's not. Like, it doesn't need to be. Maybe it's a stew who's out there taking a break on deck and sees this and goes, "That's not okay. That's not something that I'm willing to watch happen." And I understand that CHIRP exists. I understand that it is, for what it's for. I understand, hopefully, from the great practice I see on my own vessel, that I know that this isn't okay, because I can see how we do it on my vessel. And I'm going to take action, and I'm going to be the one who says something. And maybe there's a thousand examples in the interior where we've got, I
Oh,
mean,
yeah.
you mentioned use of chemicals, right? Where we've got actually an example where we've got all these chemicals, we're being forced to use them, but we don't have any, the right equipment on board to do it
I,
safely.
as you were speaking, I was just thinking, I did work on a boat that had a spiral staircase that had mirrored glass all the way around it. And obviously it was three floors, I think, if I remember correctly.
Was it a
And you're
fingerprint map in
leaning,
that tiny
but
chance?
you're leaning over the banister, because obviously the high bits also need to be cleaned, and you're literally leaning over the banister to try and clean something on something that moves all the time. And well, so the interior isn't immune to that kind of stuff,
Not at all.
and also standing on a seating bench made out of marble in a wet shower to clean and dry said wet shower. And there's loads lo there'll be loads of examples, but like I said, the interior team would probably not think that it's worthy enough to call in, because it's not a bridge problem.
Yeah, and I think that
Without
worthy is a
thinking.
bit right. It's very much the thing. I think the thing I would say is that everybody has their internal sort of risk clock, don't they? Their internal risk kind of level of what they're okay with. That varies from person to person, for sure. And I used to climb a lot, but when I was younger. And when you're exposed. Like, you do it because it's fun. That's why you do it. But you know when you've got yourself into a bit of a sticky spot. And it's the same with anybody doing any job. And if you are a member of the interior team who's doing a job, whatever that job is, and your internal little risk clock is going, "I don't know, that doesn't feel okay," then it's probably not okay. And if we've gone, and maybe it's just that feeling, or maybe it's actually, I slipped and hurt myself, or I slipped and I almost hurt myself, or this nearly happened. That's a near miss versus an incident, right? And those are the things that we can learn from. And I think if you're in that department and you're listening to this and you're going like, "Yeah, go Paul and Charisse, we need to be talking about this stuff more often." We can't talk about it if you don't tell us about it. Right. So, it's not like, "Oh, well, CHIRP only has deck and engine reports." Yeah, you're right.
You're
It
not
does.
sending them.
Because nobody sends us anything from the interior, unless it's a deck officer, safety officer probably, sending it because it was something that they heard about because it happened in the interior. Right. So we've just agreed that most of the yacht is interior. We've just agreed we've got a whole department there that is widely ignored from any kind of safety and regulatory perspectives. And if you think that shouldn't be the case, And if you think there are issues in the interior that from a safety perspective that we need to be talking about, then talk about them.
Yeah, I agree. I'm really looking forward to Chirp's campaign, you know, send out some posters that can be put in the interior, in the laundry room, you know, to record stuff like that. You know, because like you said, it's just the fact that they won't think that it's, you know, it warrants being recorded because it's just day to day. It's just the interior and all of that kind of stuff. So, you know.
Well, honestly, anything that people feel like they can share, it is beneficial. It's all hyper confidential, anonymized, like it cannot be tracked back to you in any possible way. And even if you think, but that, you know, maybe people would know that happened on our boat. There are lots of laundries on lots of yachts and the same types of accidents happen in lots of laundries. So it's not going to be something that you're going to be able to be identified from, but it is something that your colleagues can learn from. And it's something that also is a broader look in terms of the statistics. We can start to say, well, this seems to be a problem. Yeah. And then we can talk about it. The reason I can tell you that there are a lot of people right now, a lot of deck crew standing on a wet, slippery surface in the air, you know, about to kill themselves, is because we get told about it all the time. and so the only way that we can actually talk about these things is if people actually tell us. So that would be my appeal for your listeners, would be to say that we do see you. We do see the interior as an important part of the ship, and we definitely see it as an important part of what Chirp is trying to do. And if you want to be involved, if you want to submit some reports, if you want to be, you know, if we get some reports, be in that board that I mentioned that actually reviews the reports and talks about them, which is at the moment primarily deck and engine, then please reach out and you'll be more than welcome. But the absolute best thing that you can do with your team, if you're, you know, a senior member of the interior departments, would be to get the team together and take one of the reports that I mentioned about, maybe the laundry, maybe the galley, maybe the steam iron I talked about, and sit down and talk about it with your team and say, could this happen on our boat? You know, are there some similar things that maybe you kind of come to mind while we're talking about this? And if the answer is yes, then we fix it. But having that team meeting that is safety focused is so incredibly important, because if we have these things don't come to the surface otherwise. They need to be explicitly spoken about, and then that's how we learn and improve and then.
Well, you get better. Like I said at the beginning, take it from just some goss to actually using it as a report to maybe change something. Do you know what I mean? It's not just a story.
Absolutely.
You know, it's not just a story round, you know, that was a bit intense. You know, to report it and then use it rather than just a very wild story around the crew mass table. Do you know what I mean? It has value as long as it's, you know, put into the right hands. I think that's really my takeaway from this conversation.
And I think that is a fantastic takeaway from this conversation, for sure.
So I do like a bit of goss. The industry's got loads. But, you know, how do you take something that in some respects, if it stays, gossip stays trivialized, and then, for you know, push it into something that, you know, let's record it. It was a near miss, you know, or it actually resulted. That turns into data, which then turns into maybe a conversation that then turns into changing something. Okay. So, you know, people are I feel like we could do another, I reckon we can do another episode, but I'll save that for the next series.
Well, you get to ask me all of the, you know, you were surprisingly boring. I was expecting you to kind of ask me all the personal awkward questions about how I ended up in this position. All we did was talk about my jumper and then safety, which is something that's my comfortable space. I can laugh at my fashion sense and talk about safety. I've got that. Maybe we'll have to have another conversation of another time.
We can talk about how nerdy and boring you are later. You know, one at a time. You are one of those people. My stepson is a bit the same. He loves a manual. And, you know, and most normal people don't.
Yeah, I must admit, I'm the one who is I'm a closet hypocrite. I'm the guy who will tell everybody to definitely read the manual, because obviously, and then break the thing because they didn't read the manual. But it's like work versus personal, right? you know, in and actually one thing I always found difficult when I was the safety officer myself, second officer, was that I, as I mentioned, I used to climb a lot, and so my risk appetite is pretty high. I'm fine doing a lot of stupid stuff, but when you're not in a personal capacity ashore, when you're in a professional capacity on board, and your job is now to not do stupid stuff, and more importantly, in that role, to not be seen to do stupid stuff, because if the safety officer is not prioritizing safety, is not prioritizing the toolbox talk, is not prioritizing the risk assessment, not prioritizing wearing all the correct PPE and stuff, then the whole thing falls apart really down quickly. And that was something I struggled with.
I do think we can, I'm sure we'll have a lot more to talk about. I think there's a lot more we could expand on, but I think this is enough for now.
Sounds good to me.
But perfect. I would like to, you know, we've started the conversation about the female place in, you know, in its invisibility state. I quite like it that we're all invisible in some respects, but it's not really helping anything, you know. I don't think. But I think there'll be more this year. I think it's going to be quite a busy year for all of us. So I would love to have you on again. Thank you so much for being one of the first individuals for the Balls of Wisdom series.
Yeah, I love it. We're not going with Balls of Steel, then. We are going with Balls of Wisdom.
No, you can do a spin-off for the deck. It's called Balls of Steel. They'll love that. They'll love that. We're on deck.
Exactly. And then it's a whole adult Balls of Steel. It's going to be great.
Well, it just makes them sound really hard and really tough, and it's a whole podcast just talking about how stop doing stupid stuff.
Yeah, maybe that's actually not a bad idea. Like, lure them in with an attractive title. Like,
we're all superheroes. No. This is why you need to do what you're told.
That's actually genius. I'm gonna steal that. That's for sure.
Oh, you can steal it all you want.
But no, it's been great to chat, and I think I would love to you know, to see the interior taken more seriously in safety, but also the interior to take itself more seriously in terms of safety, and to engage with projects like CHIRP, which you know, currently don't really support the interior as much as they should do.
We will provide links in the bio for everybody who wants to scope out CHIRP and understand it. And, you know, I will be helping Paul probably promote it within the interior world a bit more, just as a starting point. You know, like I said, once we start recording, we can start seeing if there are, you know, are issues. But until then, listener, I hope you have, I hope you're well. We have more episodes coming out, so please check it out. And then obviously we have more episodes of the CPL Laundry podcast for you to check out. But until next time, take care of yourself and goodbye.